Hi, welcome to Lights, Camera, Author. I'm Jim Juno, and this is where we talk with authors who write books about classic Hollywood and entertainment. And if you like what you're hearing, you can find us on any streaming platform that you have, including YouTube. So we urge you to check it out. I have with me today Manfred Westfall and Josh Young. They are the co-authors of a new book coming out. It's called The Fixer: Moguls, Mobsters, Movie Stars, and Marilyn. And welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for asking. Now, this
Thanks for
is
having us.
not a problem at all. Appreciate you doing this. Now, this is the story of a man whom many people may not have heard of. So we're going to educate listeners a little bit. His name was Fred Otash. And he was known as, well, he was officially a private investigator out in Los Angeles. And but he did a lot more than that, didn't he? Manfred or Josh, whoever wants to start off.
Well, I yes, absolutely. I mean, he was I mean, there's a great deal of history that happened prior to his becoming a private detective, but he was also a fixer to the stars in the 1950s and 60s that and his life as a result intimately intertwined with some of the greatest icons of the 20th century.
I mean, that's true. He was there. I mean, it was reading your book, it was like a name dropping of all these famous Hollywood stars. And we're going back to the what you would call the glory days of the studio system, starting right after World War II, I believe. In what was it, 1946? Is that when he started with a LA police officer?
Yes, he joined the police force and he was there for about a decade. And then he left and opened up his own detective agency.
Now, what led y'all on to Fred Otash
Well,
becoming this?
it's kind of a long story, but it began almost 34 years ago. I met Fred Otash in the fall of 1990 when I was a young development coordinator at Warner Brothers Television, kind of a glorified assistant who also read scripts and, spent a great deal of my days looking for stories that could be made into miniseries or movies for television. He and my parents were good friends and neighbors at a condominium complex known as the Park Wellington, where they both lived across the street from the. You might have heard of it, the famous Sunset Marquee Hotel in West Hollywood.
Yes.
My mother introduced us. And like most anyone who ever met Fred at the time, I was immediately taken by his larger than life, stranger than fiction persona. I mean, he was like a real life Philip Marlowe or Mike Hammer, if you will, as if he just stepped out of a novel by Raymond Chandler or Mickey Spillane. And he had all these amazing stories of his heady heyday as Hollywood's go-to fixer to the stars in the 1950s and 60s. I mean, from a cinematic standpoint, you might say he checked all the boxes, the kind of a private eye franchise character personified.
Now let's educate really readers a little bit more here. What exactly? Now, you, of course, it's called The Fixer, but what exactly? And I know that this, I know what it is. It's like, that's what people, it's what the studios called when somebody got in trouble. One of their client or one of their actors got in trouble. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, so this is Josh,
Yeah, Josh.
Jim. That was Manfred before, obviously. A fixer is a professional problem solver who works in the shadows and provides specialized crisis management for the Hollywood elite. In modern times, where many of us are familiar with the character of Ray Donovan, who is a modern Hollywood fixer, sort of a Dark Knight anti-hero who comes to the aid of the city's rich and famous. Otash was the real life Ray Donovan of his day. And in fact, the show's creator and star Leah Freiberg often cite Otash as a key inspiration for that title character. So the fixer is somebody who operates behind the scenes and gets people out of jams, famous people out of jams.
That's right. And go ahead.
He's kind of the person you call when you can't call conventional law enforcement.
Right. I mean, this is before the cops were even notified. They would call the studio fixer to come in and clean up things. You mentioned in the book, you know, he had a, for those of you who aren't familiar with, there was a magazine called Confidential, it was a scandal rag. I mean, it dealt in exposing the dark secrets of Hollywood stars and that nature. And, he was quite a influence in the trial, the confidential trial, wasn't he?
Yes. He was the chief investigator for Confidential magazine. So when the studios went after the magazine, he played a key role in subpoenaing pretty much all the biggest names in Hollywood to testify at the trial. And as a result, there was an exodus out of LA that rivaled that of Moses at the time of, you know, the Egypt. Oh, I didn't get that right. There was a major exodus out of Hollywood.
Oh, exactly.
But yeah, just to back up. So Confidential was, if you'll think of it as a precursor and an even nastier version of the National Enquirer. It hit the newsstands in 1952, and its sole vow was to tell the facts and name the names. And its publisher had no interest in playing ball with the studios or playing ball with the stars. So any morsel of juicy gossip or untoward behavior that he could get his hands on, he would put in the magazine. And when Fred went to work for Confidential as an independent contractor, if you will, his job was to fact check these stories and in most cases and to make sure that they were correct. And during that time, he ended up working with several of the people or working investigating stories on several of the people who he later worked for.
He met Liberace when Liberace was just starting out. And
yeah, that's a good story. Tell that story, Manfred, because this is interesting because Fred operates in the gray area, and it was not all good, and but certainly not all bad. So, tell that story, Manfred. That's one of your favorites.
Well, he was working undercover. He first met Liberace when he was a vice cop, and he was working undercover one night at a bar, and Liberace came on to him in essence, and he did his due diligence and arrested him. But once he took him outside to finish the job, so to speak, he was quite charmed by Liberace and decided to let him go.
And that was a rare exception, wasn't it?
And he vowed to keep his eye on his career.
Yeah, because he was unknown at this time, Liberace, that is.
Yeah,
he had just arrived in Hollywood.
Now, what I liked about reading your book is that Fred Otesh was bawled out by a great number of people in the book. We're going to touch a little bit on that, like when he went to work for people he went to work for. We're talking about Judy Garland. We're talking about Lana Turner. We're talking about, and also and Marilyn Monroe. But let's start with Marilyn Monroe. When he met her, back when she was still known as Norma Jean Baker.
Yeah, he met her at John Carroll's ranch in the San Fernando Valley. John Carroll was a big actor at that time, and he had met Fred when he was a police officer. He and his wife Doris Houck, who was a starlet, a Columbia Studios starlet, and so he became quite close with them and often frequented the ranch. And that's where he met a young Norma Jean at that time when she, you know, she was just starting out.
And he noticed her right away, her, that she had talent. And I was just wondering that, but, you know, he, we talk about people he worked for. I want to back up a little bit here because you two, first off, you knew him, Manfred, I believe, was it Manfred, you knew him, right?
Yes.
Right. And you guys had access to his secret files. But you didn't get access to what was known as the Red Cabinet.
That's the fire engine red filing cabinet. I had first seen it. Backing up a little bit. So, you know, my mother introduced Fred and I, and she had read an article in GQ magazine in the October issue of in 1990 of GQ that was a pretty substantial story about Fred and his career. And she gave that to me, and then I subsequently met him.
We met
for dinner one night at their home. And like I said, I was immediately taken by him. So I pretty much offered, based on my limited experience that I had at the studios at that time, to kind of be his wingman, so to speak, to help him navigate, the Hollywood ecosystem at that time and work with him to, you know, hopefully bring his story, to television or film or, you know, any medium that was available at that time. And I was encouraged when he invited me to come over to his house and look at his scrapbooks. So about a week later, I arrived to meet him again. And there was these two giant scrapbooks laid out on his kitchen table, the likes of which I had never seen. I mean, they were enormous, and they contained all the clippings that he had accumulated over the course of his career, even going back from his days on the police force and throughout his work as a private eye. But what really stood out was this red filing cabinet that was in his kitchen that could be locked by inserting a key in this top bolt and pushing it inwards. And I asked him what that was, and he said, you know, those are my private files. You know, nobody, those are my hot files. Nobody goes in there but me. And that's where he kept, you know, all the major case files that were obviously extremely private. And when he died, that was the first thing that his executor, Arthur Crowley, had removed from his unit, and it was never seen again.
I don't doubt it. Yeah, it probably was destroyed immediately, or at least the files inside of it were.
Right.
But now, you know, you show a lot of things in this book, which, well, I'm going to say it right now. Some people may consider it just be gossip, but you actually have papers and do you have any recordings? Because you, on Rock Hudson, you transcribed the recording.
Well, Fred kept a file on Rock Hudson. So again, to back up a little bit. So when Fred died, I met his daughter Colleen at the funeral, and we became friends. And in time, she entrusted me with access to the remains of the day, if you will. I mean, what was left behind, which was 11 boxes of investigative files that he kept in a vault in Bank of America. And it was just a treasure trove of everything, investigative files and transcripts and legal documents and photography and personal ephemera, et cetera. And as far as Rock Hudson is concerned, there's a file, Hudson versus Hudson. And in that file was the transcripts of the recordings that was taken the night that that Rock Hudson came out to his wife during the divorce proceeding.
And at that time she was suing him for divorce, and Fred was working for her attorney, trying to get Rock to admit, which he did on that audio tape, the transcripts of which we published in the book, that Rock was essentially gay and had been gay and had many lovers since the day they were married.
Fred had scripted the questions for her.
And at that point, and this is a case in a lot of, and this is a situation in a lot of Fred's cases. I mean, here he was supporting a woman who was, you know, essentially being kicked to the curb by Rock, he was offering her no money and, you know, secondhand car and cutting her out, basically. And this was a situation where not only was it a job for Fred, but that frankly wasn't fair. Right. And as a result of his work, she was able to stay in her house and obtain a piece of his production company and a sum of money that she could live off of.
Now, you also talk about the night that Lana Turner's boyfriend, Johnny Stompanato, was murdered. And the general accepted story is that Lana Turner's daughter, Cheryl Crane, Stompanato charged at Cheryl Crane, and she had the knife, and it basically was self-defense, knife plunge. But really, you found evidence that wasn't the case, correct?
Well, yeah, that story remains one of the greatest Hollywood murder mysteries of all time, you might say. Fred was called to the scene by Lana's power attorney, Jerry Geisler, long before the police arrived, to clean up and, I guess you could say, help mitigate and minimize the collateral damage of what everyone there that night knew would become a tremendous scandal, which was Lana's worst nightmare. And as a result, Lana was never prosecuted, and Cheryl took the rap for what the coroner's inquest ruled a justifiable homicide. But Fred had firsthand knowledge of what led up to and went down that Good Friday night in 1958 and shocked Hollywood and the world. And let's just say it directly conflicts with the official version.
Now, let's talk a little bit I was stunned when you said that Peter Lawford, I didn't realize that he was such a, I guess you might call a sleazeball, you know?
Well, I wouldn't say he was a sleazeball. In a way, you have to kind of look at all of this and this period of time through the context of that period of time. He was certainly a playboy.
Yeah, he was a raffish, fun-loving, hard-partying guy who, you know, who obviously was a cousin of the Kennedys, but you know, was also in the Rat Pack with Frank Sinatra, and you know, at times had a tense relationship with Sinatra. So I think some of the things he did might appear to be a little off kilter, but I think if you put him, yeah, as Manfred said,
you might say they were all swinging, booze swilling superstars.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yes. When you're looking back at it from the eyes of 2024, it, you know, back in those days of 1950s, early 60s, it was a totally different viewpoint in the Hollywood world.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think you have to kind of look at this through the context of what Hollywood was like back at that time, which was rather a lawless place in many ways.
Now, everybody knows about the story about Marilyn Monroe and John F. Kennedy. You know, regardless if it was a one-night affair or if it went on for a while, but I did not realize until I read your book that Kennedy... Marilyn Monroe wasn't the first, of course, wasn't the first woman he slept with, but wasn't even the first blonde bombshell Hollywood starlet that he slept with. That was Jane Mansfield. And I had never heard a word about Kennedy and Jane Mansfield until I read your book.
Yeah, that's straight from the horse's mouth. That was information that Fred uncovered when he first started taping Lawford's Beach House,
where Kennedy, prior to being elected president, would come to the West Coast and enjoy himself.
Yeah, he would go out hunting, as your book says. And now, how do you answer? I'm gonna play devil's advocate here. How would you answer the charge that this is all gossip and you don't have, you know, but you do have hard evidence for some of this stuff, don't you? For most of this stuff.
Well, Fred left transcripts. Fred made recordings before his death. He was preparing. He was in the process of writing his memoir, his second memoir, because he penned and published Investigation Hollywood in 1976, which was a rather tame book at that time, because he chose not to really reveal everything that he knew. Fred often said that, you know, I'm not a liar. I don't tell everything I know either.
Words to live by, yeah.
and that, yeah, that exactly. That was kind of his mantra, based on what he experienced in his life and his career as a private detective. And in preparing for his memoir, he left hours of recordings. And it is those recordings and those direct quotes that are used, that are in the book, that come directly from those transcripts. So, and we italicize them in the book. So that those are straight from the mouth of Fred Otash.
Josh, how did you feel when you saw all this information?
Well, having been a former reporter, entertainment reporter, when somebody comes to you with all of this information, this you know, treasure trove of information, that's all sourced, you know, it's amazing. And not only was it an amazing story, but the material was there to back it up, and rich in detail and factual. So you had somebody who was a firsthand observer to all of these events, and that's very rare. Generally, you're scrambling to find people who knew people who knew people who won't talk to you about these events. So it's very rare that something like this, you know, comes along. And that was obviously one of the reasons I wanted to work on the book.
You know,
that's what I found so fascinating. You know, after when Fred died and I came into possession of the files, and I started to go through them, and I never really went through them as much as we had to do for the writing of this book. I mean, part of you has to be an archivist, an archaeologist, so to speak. And you find yourself going back in time, and you're holding all of these documents in your hand that are decades old. I mean, in the case of the Rock Hudson transcripts, you know, the original onion skin paper, that is, you know, almost miraculously hasn't fallen apart over time. And then I had the tapes of his recordings. And I remember when I first transcribed them, and I sat up practically for days in my apartment near the La Brea Tar Pits I had to buy this, you know, new kind of newfangled machine that took a cassette tape and then transferred it to a computer file, and just sat there for days and days, you know, writing everything down as I was listening to it and going back and forth and back and forth. So it was an incredible experience, and to hear him from the grave, so to speak, finally, in a way, telling, in that moment, it felt like he was telling me things that he had never told me before.
Exactly.
And
it
was a revelating experience.
Now, he was supposed to be on 2020. And apparently the story, and they flew him from Nice in France to New York, and then Los Angeles, and then back again. And they paid him like $250 a day. And
yeah, that was just per diem.
Per diem, yes.
But they didn't really pay him for the actual appearance.
Right. But But they interview him for 2 days, which I'm assuming is several hours each day. And then, of course, it's going to get cut down from that raw time to, and I think it was like 18 minutes first, and then it became 15 minutes, and then 13 minutes, and suddenly it was all, it was canceled.
Yeah, it was death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah, so 2020 was doing a piece on Marilyn's death, and Fred had many years contemplated addressing what he knew, what happened on the night that Marilyn died, August 4th, 1962. And many people had come out with differing accounts, false accounts, accounts that they were making money off of. And so when this call came in August of 1985 to go on 2020 and tell what he knew, I think Fred at that time felt he was ready to unburden himself and just let the truth lie where it may. And during the, he did go to New York, as you mentioned, Jim. He did 2 days of interviews, and eventually the piece was cut down considerably and then was spiked by Rune Arledge, who was then the president of ABC News, for reasons that are explained in the book and are still a little bit murky, but caused a great upheaval at ABC. All of the anchors at the time, the anchors of 2020, Barbara Walters and Hugh Downs, were very upset at this. The correspondent, N.A. Rissner, who was their best correspondent, ended up leaving the network. Geraldo Rivera, who was at 2020 then, was upset over other things. But when they spiked this piece, that also contributed to him leaving. So it was a pretty big deal that this piece never saw the light of day. And we do reveal, though, obviously, what Fred knew and what happened that night that Marilyn died in the book.
Exactly. Yes. And if you want to find more about it, then you need to go out and buy it, guys. So listeners, so I appreciate both of you guys to come tonight, Manfred Westfall and Josh Young. And the book is called The Fixer, and the full title is Moguls, Mobsters, Movie Stars, and Marilyn. Josh and Manfred, I want to thank you for appearing on Lights, Camera, Author today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
It's been a pleasure.
Enjoyed it.